So this morning we were discussing various aspects of mind and how we respond to different experiences from external world and also from our own mind. Our excessive obsession, excessive liking for certain things called raga, excessive hatred or aversion to certain other things. Now, you know, mind plays a very important role in spiritual life. So the analysis of mind and its functions is a very important subject, because the purpose is to make us understand that we are not the mind. We take mind too seriously and think that mind is all that exists. In a way, that's true. But mind itself, by itself, is a very, very insignificant, almost irrelevant part of our true dimension. Now, if I make a statement like this, I know it's a bit odd. So what I want to say is, of course, I'll try to explain this with the help of a dialogue from Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, which is a very celebrated dialogue. Before that, let us see what is our mind as it functions. Mind can be compared to a lake with different layers. If you have got any doubt, you try to sit calmly somewhere and try to meditate. Try to observe inaction at the physical level. Then mind immediately throws up impressions, ideas, memories, which we never really imagined existed within our mental system. So when I use the word mental system, you know, you have to remember, mental system here means a combination of mana, buddhi, chitta and ahankara, as understood in Vedanta and Yoga, or to put it in modern English, the speculative faculty, the cognitive faculty, the instrument with which we pursue, cognize things, think about different objects, and the repository of all memories, impressions. All together could be called mental system in this particular context. So the word used in Patanjali system is chitta. So chittam it is regarded. So it is a neutral gender. Now, as I said, mind can be compared to a lake with different layers. So when we sit quiet, when we try to meditate or think or contemplate deeply, what we are doing in effect is we are taking a long stick and we are trying to stir the mental system. So different objects, different things, dust, bacteria, all these will emerge from different layers of the mental system. Or mind could be compared to a bag, which contains two types of impressions, samskaras, good and bad. So all the time we feel conflict because some samskaras, some accumulated tendencies, which are in favor of what we are trying to do, and some which are not in favor of what we are trying to do, are creating a friction, a conflict. So that's why we feel internal conflict. That's why many modern psychiatrists are trying to analyze and solve the problems of multiple personality and some forms of schizophrenia and even the three types of delusions, like delusions of persecution, delusions of reference, and delusions of grandeur. Many of these problems are rooted in the past accumulated samskaras, not accumulated in this life, accumulated in previous life. Because there are many problems, actions and tendencies and characteristics which cannot be explained in the light of events and childhood memories pertaining to this life. So if you extend the logic beyond this life, then it should have a cause somewhere else, previous life. So in this context, mind can be compared to a bag of two different types of categories of samskaras, impressions, vrittis, and all that. Now, Patanjali's system in the beginning of the Sadhanapada recommends one simple method which needs a lot of explanations. His recommendation is this. Kriya Yoga is the first step in all kinds of problem-solving mechanisms at the mental level. So, tapasvadhyaya ishara pridhanani kriya yoga. That's what he says. Where it's just a sutra, it is a very, very simple statement. So, aphorism. So, tapa means some kind of intense effort, self-control, self-restraint. It's not very obvious from the sutra itself. Swadhyaya is more clear. It means reading. Here, reading should be extended to accumulating ideas, positive ideas, spiritually helpful ideas, ideas that help us in our life. By reading, by listening to, or through any process. That is swadhyaya. Ishvara pradhana means surrendering to God. Now, it has got a great psychological significance in the devotional traditions of all religions. In fact, St. Augustine says, confession to be effective is only once. If you really confess once, it also includes the ideal of self-surrender to God, which means you are actually opening your life system for God to interfere. So you become an instrument in the hands of God. If you really sincerely believe in that, then that will be the end of all problems. I can give the example, of course, the classical example that comes to our mind immediately is the case of Girishchandra Ghosh. But you find such instances in all traditions. St. Augustine, the great theologian, is an example. You know, he had a new life when he listened to, when he came in contact with the great statement from the Bible. You find many such cases, but Girishchandra Ghosh's system is important, you know, example, illustration. He was a profligate, a drunkard, a man who led a very indisciplined, wayward life. He did this Ishvara Panidhana. He surrendered himself to Sri Ramakrishna in the power of attorney, means complete surrender. Prapatti or Saranagati means you look upon God as the only protector, the only refuge, and you direct your mind towards God all the time. You completely reject all negative thought currents, and then a kind of self-surrender. Anugulyasya sankalpaha pradigulyasya varjanam rakshasididhi vishwasaha goptrutta varanam tatha atmanikshepa karpanne sarvidha saranakati. It's a definition given by the Vaishnava philosopher Ramanuja. So that's what I said earlier. Rejection of all negative thought currents, negativity, and completely pursue a path of positive thoughts and ideas. That's very important. Because if you're weak, then negative ideas from the wrong persons can capture you. So the Vaishnavite philosophers, others say you should have a filtering mechanism within your system. How do we do that? When we listen to negative ideas, you cannot fight with the person because the world is 8 billion people are not necessarily seekers of spiritual life. So there could be negative ideas. You have to live in the big world, in the professional life, in workplace. So competition, all this will happen. So how to do that? If you fight with them, that will be a big problem. That also will be opening your mind system to their influence. If you befriend them, that also will be surrendering your personality. So in both ways, either you hate somebody or you become very friendly with somebody who is a negative type of person, you will be practically affected by their influence. So what to do? Indifference. As you often mention, you know, we do practice indifference in everyday life. When you go to Trader Joe, somebody says, "Have a great day," you don't take it very seriously. then, so as I mentioned, you know, one Indian gentleman may be coming from an Indian countryside who has never been to the West. He said, oh, in America, even in business shops, they pray for your welfare. So when you give a package, you put your money, have a great day, have a good day, and things like that. So we don't, but people here won't take it seriously. They know that it is, you have a filtering mechanism which prevents you from taking that seriously. So like that, there are negative ideas which also should be filtered out. So that's what Ramanuja says. So for this Kriya Yoga is recommended. In fact, this filtering mechanism is a very easy path. Easy means to solve many of the problems. We should not befriend wrong ideas, and we should not fight with wrong ideas. Because either hating or hatred or extreme liking, both are equally one or other way of opening your system to outside negative influence. So, indifference. So, this is what is mentioned. Filtering mechanism, internal filtering mechanism. If you can develop it, then we can avoid a lot of problems. Now, this is what is recommended. It's called Kriya Yoga. That is Patanjali's definition of Kriya Yoga. Tapaha, Swadhyayaha, Isharam Pranidhanani. So the third one is surrendering to God, Prapatti or Sharanagati, because that helps us to keep ourselves linked to a great ideal, God, religion, or spirituality. So once you are linked to that, then problems at the mental level will be absolutely no problems at all. Now I mentioned one point at the very beginning, mind is not a very serious thing. Once you understand, problems will be no more problems because all the serious problems are the mental level. I can give this dialogue to demonstrate this point. In the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, there is a very interesting dialogue between a great king, his name is Janaka, and a great sage philosopher, his name is Yajnavalkya. One of the greatest philosophers of ancient India. So this sage, one day, visits the emperor, the king. Now, in those days, when great men, great sages, whenever they visited a court, a king's court or the emperor's place, the king will request that sage to expound some philosophical, spiritual topic that will be useful in our life. So you find in the Mahabharata, there are almost 3,000 dialogues. Mahabharata, you know, the shortest version of Mahabharata has more than 100,000 verses. And the largest version, 145,000 verses. So Bhagavad Gita is 700 verses, only a tiny fraction of the whole Mahabharata. So there are thousands of dialogues in such classics. So here is one dialogue, one of the most celebrated dialogues in the Vedic literature, Upanishad. So Yajnavalkya comes to the court. Then Janaka asks a very simple question, which may appear to be almost childish. How do we live in this world? How do we go about, do our duty, come back to our place and sit? How do we do that? The simple question, how do you go out and come back and sit on a chair? So, Kim Jyotirayam Purushayadi, means this is how it begins. Endowed with what light is a human being able to go about, wander about, do his or her duties and come back? This is a simple question. The ancient dialogues, apparently, if you take literally, they are very, very simple. But they contain a profound message. So Yajnavalkya gave a reply, sunlight. That's true. In those days, that was the only light or moonlight. Then Janaka asked next question. Astamide aditya Yajnavalkya kim jyotirayam purushayiti. Means suppose now the sun has set in the west. Let us say 8 o'clock, 9 o'clock. Then what light enables you to move about, to live in this world, to do our things? Yajnavalkya said this is moonlight. Fine, that's very nice. These are all simple, straightforward questions and answers, which even children can answer. The third question, suppose there is no sunlight, it's night. There is no moonlight, dark, cloudy night. Then what will you do for moving about, if you have to move about, return to your place, do some work? Well, what we will strike a match. You start a fire. That's what, a fireplace. That's all we do. So he's Agni. So, Kim Jyotirayam Purusha is the question. What literally it means, you know, endow with what light is a person able to move about, do his or her duties, and come back to the place, sit there. So if there is no sunlight, if there is no moonlight, it's with pitch darkness at night, then you have to take the help of a fire. Now here, what is the meaning of light? Jyoti is the word used. Light, you know, what is the function of light? Light reveals things. And light has got an additional function. Light reveals itself. Now, this book can be revealed by light. But this book cannot reveal other objects. But light can reveal other objects. And light can reveal itself. So revealing of its existence is the function of light. Revealership is the light. Now, if you don't have sunlight or moonlight or fire, suppose you are sitting in a dark room, no sun, no light of any kind, how do you know, how do you get light, knowledge about a vehicle moving the street? Still, you come to know of many things, people walking upstairs, a car moving the streets. We come to know of these objects existing through vagjyoti, through word, speech, or sound functioning as light. Again, light doesn't mean just tube light or any, what do you understand, physical light. Light is the principle of knowledge. Light is the principle of revealership. Because, as I said, light reveals, illumines other things, and it reveals its own existence. This twofold function is possible only for light. So, Yajnavalkya said, Vagjyoti, speech, sound, or voice. And then he asked the question, suppose there is no sunlight, sun is set in the west, no moonlight, cloudy, dark night, and you are deaf, you can't hear things, and there is no fire. And you sit somewhere. Still, many things are revealed to you. What are they? You sit somewhere and remember what you saw that day morning before the sun set in the west. Or you may remember what you heard, what you did maybe 10 years back. All these memories, samskaras, will come back to the mind. And, you know, memory is nothing but a kind of re-experiencing, reliving. Every time when we remember, we see, hear, smell, all this happens. When you remember the wonderful ice cream you ate, you know, that memory comes back to you in the form of taste that you feel, but not at a physical level, mental level. When you remember a music that you heard yesterday or 10 years back, that's how you are able to recite. The musician is not there who taught you. Musician has left, but you still practice, even in his absence. How are we able to practice? Because we hear again, not a physical level, mental level, we hear again. It is memory. So also we see things at the mental level. So memory is nothing but a revival of experiences at the subtle level. At a gross level, we experience with the help of mind and the five senses of perception. And we work with the mind and five senses of action. We walk in memory. Well, how does it happen? Because we recollect the memory from a previous walking experience, which was gross at that time. Now, when we relive that, it is subtle. The subtle experiences take place at the mental level. Gross experiences take place when mind and the sensory system are both involved. So, Yajnavalkya was asked this question. Suppose we don't see things with our eyes, no sunlight, no moonlight, no fire, we can't even hear, then still you are not in total, you are not in a state of total unconsciousness. There is still awareness in you. You still live in the world of ideas, knowledge, experiences. So what enables you? Then Yajnavalkya answer, here is a light. That light is not an external light, less sunlight. It is not moonlight, it's also an external thing. Or a fire. Or worse, that light is within yourself. That light is Atma Jyoti, which Upanishads call Jyotisham Jyoti, light of all lights. Because this Atma Jyoti is the basis of all other lights. Your mind gets its ability to think, to speculate from Atman. Because Atman is present, so mind is a tool or instrument. So mind becomes functional when it is linked, connected to the source of all knowledge. And that Atman functions at the mental level in the form of thoughts and speculations. The same Atman functions at the intellectual level in the form of cognitive faculty. Now, our mind is only an instrument. That's why I said mind is only an instrument. Mind is, you know, an instrument is only an instrument. It is not the source of anything. So very frequently we forget that point. When we face stress and tension, we identify ourselves with that mind which is feeling tension and stress. Suppose we can dissociate ourselves from that mental system and try to assert our true identity. I am not this mind. So to say that you are this mind is not different from to saying that you are this body. So Atman eats food, Atman eats salad, Atman eats bread. We don't say that. So if somebody says, well, I'm going through a lot of stress. People commit suicide because of stress. Why? Because they identify themselves with this insignificant, irrelevant instrument. So, if you have a stick in your hand, if somebody cuts that stick, you are not hurt. If somebody cuts the hand that's holding the stick, you will be hurt. Here, our mind is only like a stick that you're holding in your hand. Or an umbrella. If somebody hits the umbrella, you won't feel the pain. So, if something happens to your mind, why should we feel tension? Why should there be a problem if mind is affected? But really speaking, you know, all the problems emerge because we identify ourselves with the mind. It's like identifying ourselves with the umbrella that we are holding, or the stick that we are using, is a walking stick, or any instrument that we have got. So this dialogue is a very interesting dialogue. Of course, it has got profound significance from Advaita Vedanta. I'm not going to those aspects. Shankaracharya has written a famous commandery called Jyoti Brahmanam. Jyoti Brahmanam is one of the most celebrated Brahmanams or sections in the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad. I'm not going to this philosophical parts of it. But there's a great significance in this dialogue. Because Yajnavalkya says the real thing that matters in plain English is our Atman. Everything else is an instrument. It is not an extension of our body. It's like a stick that you hold in your hand. See, if that stick gets cut, we are not hurt. So why should we feel the pain, the stress, the tension of the problem when mind is affected? But mostly, we look upon the mind as ourselves. Of course, Vedanta, we know this called, there is a description, Maya, Mithya, I'm not going to those things. In short, the whole point is, mind is only a very insignificant point. Another thing I mentioned yesterday, that's also should be understood in this context. The idea of rebirth, reincarnation, the idea of law of karma, the idea that death is only a transition point, the end of the body is not end of the journey or the game of life, it is only a transition point. So, problems related to sickness, diabetes, hypertension, which make people lose the sleep. Well, at one point, we can assert our true identity. My Atman is not becoming diabetic patient. It is not suffering from hypertension. That's my true self. And not only that, if this hypertension reaches its the worst case scenario, it is not the end of anything. So it is only the tip of the iceberg that we normally take into consideration. What is the tip of the iceberg? This life. Suppose there is an iceberg which is 100 feet tall and only 10 feet is visible on the surface, above the water level. 90 feet below the water. So what is invisible, we don't take into consideration. We can take into consideration only what is visible, that is 10 feet of the iceberg, that is this life. Now, as I mentioned, once we understand and assert our true identity that we are Atman, it is a great help. I am not dismissing other methods. See, one can spend $1,000 per hour for this pep talks and this management, all this wonderful. And, you know, I'm told it is not a speculation, but I can tell you what some professionals revealed to me on condition that I should not tell their name. See, they said one interesting thing. They say many people attend these programs for reducing tension and stress. Or suppose your performance is going down, you attend a kind of orientation so that your performance will increase. The company itself promotes and finances all this. You know. So you are able to stand, you are asked to stand straight and stretch your both hands upward. So you are stressed to the maximum. Now you should try to stress half an inch above. That means you should try to become smarter and smarter, more and more successful. And then you should shout 100 times, I shall win, I shall succeed. And with full conviction that you will win, you will succeed. And at the end of the day, you pay $1,000 per day. Now, suppose you have paid $1,000 and come back. A friend asks you, did it really work? If you say, oh, it's all nonsense, then they make you are a fool to have spent $1,000. So you don't want that bad name. So in order to avoid your prestige, they may call you crazy to have spent $1,000 with practically nothing. So you don't want to be known as somebody who has wasted $1,000 for a session which really didn't work at all. It's certainly not a compliment. family members also may not be amused. That's another. But so the whole point is, so you want to make it, you want to say, yes, it really worked. Now, because you have to tell your friends it worked to save your prestige and to avoid being called a fool. So what happens? Yes, it really worked and I have improved a lot. Now, when you really believe, of course you want to believe, you want to believe. So what happens? This sincere effort to avoid being called a fool really helps you to improve your performance. This is the psychological explanation. Anyway, I'm not going deep into those things because these are all, therefore these methods deal with the problem only at a very, very superficial level. Not even 10 feet of the iceberg above. Just a few inches. What I'm really going to discuss is another aspect of our character. It may help us to understand as to what we are, why we behave the way we behave, why we talk the way we talk and behave and take life the way we are taking our life. It is, as I mentioned yesterday, you know, our actions produce a residual element called vritti. It becomes an abstract, general tendency called samskara. And the samskara becomes a strong tendency to act. It becomes vasana. That vasana again makes you to take certain decisions to continue the same activity. It's called sankalpa. And then you decide to act in nischaya, again leads to action, and this action again produces vritti. So it is called karma vritti chakram. Chakram is a wheel. So karma is action. Vritti, karma, vritti, samskara, vasana, sankalpa, nischaya, karma, vritti, samskara, like this. So this is a cycle. Now this is what we experience in our everyday life. So this is one part which is rather gross. But what really decides our character is not this. It is related to this particular part, but it is much more subtle. It is called karmasaya in the language of yoga philosophers. What is karmasaya? So karmasaya is what may be called the residue of all actions, the karmic residue. In a way, it is the abstract of our true character. If you can ask the question, why am I responding to this problem in this particular way? Why am I behaving this manner? It's because this is my character. Why is this character? How did I evolve this character? The answer is, this is my karmasya. So all the actions do not necessarily mean just physical actions. Any kind of action that creates a vritti. It could be a thought, a flash of an idea. It could be a desire to do something. Or it could be an action itself. Any of these can create something that remains after the particular action is over. Means if you think some noble idea, well, we forget it. But it will create a ripple, it will register an impression in our mental system, which in course of time becomes solidified and it constitutes this karmic residue at the macro level. And it is called karmasya. So it's like a huge, let us say, a huge repository of a number of impressions, not gross impressions, solidified impressions, which constitute our character. Now, what to do with this character that we have got? This character we have inherited. And this character is formed from the abstract of all the thoughts and ideas, actions, which became vritti, samskara, so on, over the last several lives. That's why we have to look below the water level. So modern psychology looks at the 10 feet of the iceberg that is visible above the water. Life as we, the life as we experience today in this life. But to understand our true nature, means karmasya, we have to take into consideration the 90 feet of the iceberg that is below the water level. And once we understand this, anyone can start a new life any day, any moment. And that is a great promise of Gita and also yoga. That's a very interesting aspect of the teachings of yoga, Gita. Gita says, Bhagavad Gita says, if you want to start, want to change your destiny right now, today, now you can begin your effort. You need not wait for anybody to come and interfere. You need not go to a temple and pay the priest. You need not go to a church and listen to a sermon. You need not depend upon somebody who will act on your behalf and will talk with God as your representative. You can talk with your true self, your Atman. What if we try to become unselfish? If we try to make our actions, our life unselfish, noble and pure, then you start your inward journey, spiritual evolution right now, today. That is what yoga says. That's why Lord Krishna says in the 6th chapter, Tatratam buddhisam yogam labhade paurodekhikam yatadeja tado bhuyasam siddhu kurunandana. The meaning is this. When you are reborn again, with whatever little good samskaras, spiritual samskaras, sincerely you pursued, you are born with this legacy. It's like a checkbook with fountain pen attached. What do? When you are born again, it is not an empty slate. You know, Locke's concept of tabula rasa is the very antithesis of yoga and Vedanta. You mean every child is born with an empty slate. So you can, it's like a clay out of which you can make a pot, a glass, or a cup, or whatever you want. No. You are not born with an empty slate. We are born with our system and we inherit a legacy of samskaras. So once we understand this, we can start the process. What's the process? We can add new samskaras. As I mentioned, you know, this karmasaya is a repository. It's called karmic residue. It is invisible, but it is what really leads to next birth. It is what really decides what type of persons we are going to be born as. Of course, in the Brahma Sutra Bhashya, Shankaracharya, there is a sutra. Tandara Pradivattu Ramkadi Samparishuktaha Prasna Nirupanabhyam. There is a great sutra on which there is a debate between Shankaracharya and Vyasa. I mean, Tandara Pradivattu Ramkadi Samparishuktaha Prasna Nirupanabhyam. Tandara Pradivattu Dehantara Pradivattu Ramkadi Gachadi. Like that. Sushmalingehi Alingita. Like that, you know, there is the commentary Shankara Bhashya continues. I will try to explain this in very simple, plain English. What it means is how we travel from one life to another life, travel from one body to another body, giving up the old, battered, exhausted, tired, useless body system. How we evolve and travel to another body. That's the description here. How Jiva travels. I mean, I'm not going to the whole detail of the sutra and the statement and the commentary. What it means is, we travel അക്കമ്പനീഡ് ബൈ ദിസ് അന്തക്കരണ മന ബുദ്ധി ചിത്ത ആൻഡ് അഹങ്കാര വിസ് എഗൻ കണ്ടെയ്ൻ ഓൾ അക്യുമുലേറ്റഡ് സംസ്കാരസ് വൃത്തീസ് ഇംപ്രഷൻസ് മെമ്മറീസ് ആൻഡ് വി സ്റ്റാർട്ട് എ ന്യൂ ലൈഫ് നൗ വാട്ട് അബൌട്ട് ദി പേരൻസ് ദോസ് പേരൻസ് ഓൾസോ ഷുഡ് ബി റെഡി ടു റിസീവ് ദ ഗസ്റ്റ് ദ ന്യൂ കമർ ഹു ഈസ് ഗോയിങ് ടു ബി ബോൺ ടു ദം സോ അക്കോർഡിംഗ് ടു ദേ സംസ്കാരസ് whether they deserve to be the parents of a Buddha or a Jesus, good people or noble people or the opposite, which I am not going to name. If they have done good actions, if they have led pure good life, then they will receive a good person as their guest, the newcomer, their children, baby. Or they will get the opposite. So there is a mutual concordance, you know. Mutual concordance. There is a kind of internal, interdependent system which is very rhythmic. So their karmasya, their character, should correspond to the character of the person who is born to them. So the central message coming to our subject is, if you observe your problems, you should remember, you consider these problems so serious, so insurmountable. If even a small problem appears to be a big dilemma, it's because you identify yourself with this mind alone, or this body, which are nothing but insignificant things which come and go. To identify ourselves with our mind is like identifying ourselves with the umbrella that we are holding in our hands. It's not part of our system. Our system is something that is different and above. It is something that goes beyond body, mind, intellect. It is Atman. As I mentioned, the mind gets its ability to think and speculate from Atman. The buddhi, the intellect, gets its ability to cognize, to perceive, think, and so on from Atman. So Atman is the source of everything. That's why Jyotisham Jyoti. That's why Yajnavalkya calls it Jyotisham Jyoti. So that Atman is our true personality. Then what about this karmasya, all this? All these are there which really create problems for us, so long as we do not identify ourselves with what we truly are, the Atman. And so long as we wrongly identify with what we really are not, this body, this mind, this intellect. So we should be able to look below the water level, below that part of the iceberg that is seen above the water. To give an example, a very vivid graphic illustration of how these karmas, vritti, samskaras actually function, I shall give one narrative from a spiritual classic, Bhagavata Purana. That's again in the form of a story. It may take a little longer, but then that will be the natural conclusion of today's topic, so it may take a little longer than that. It's the story of Jatabharata. Many of you, Jatabharata, you know, remember his real name was Bharata. Jatabharata literally means, you know, Bharata, the dead, the mute, the dull. But that is a later name. There is a reason why he was called Jatabharata. Bharata was the name of the person. He was a great emperor, and according to some historians, India got ancient name Bharata Varsha from this Jatabharata. And according to some other scholars and their views, India got this name Bharata Varsha or Bharata from another Bharata who belonged to the Dushyanta, that another dynasty. Anyway, that is not our topic right now. So the name of this king was Bharata. He was a very enlightened emperor. And he was a very, very noble king, well known for his wisdom. In a way, he was what we described this morning, Rajarshi, a philosopher king. He combined in his personality the sageliness, the contemplative nature, the wisdom of a sage, and the efficiency of a king. He was such a great man. When he became old, he thought he will enter the third stage of his life. What's the third stage? When you become old, there is a statement in Manusmriti. He was a great lawgiver during Vedic times. A very great statement. What Manu says, there's a verse, Grihastasya yada pasyet vali palidam atmanaha apatyasya apatyam tada aranyam samasriye. This is a statement. Literally, it means what it means. An householder, when he gets old, I mean, when his hair becomes gray, or when his face becomes wrinkled, and that's not enough, when he sees the face of his grandson or granddaughter, which is a guarantee that the lineage will be preserved, then he should not try to reverse the metabolism by going to beauty parlor, trying to blacken the hair and whiten the teeth. Instead of that, what he should do or she should do, should retire to a place of contemplation when the hair is gone gray, face is wrinkled, and you see your grandchildren. So no problem, your lineage is preserved. That's apatyasya apatyam, means grandchildren. Then he should not remain at home, be busy with worldly things. He should retire, both husband and wife, and spend the rest of their lifetime in contemplation and meditation. And you'll be surprised when I tell you, many of the great sages mentioned in Vedic literature, in the Mahabharata, in the Bhagavata, all the Indian spiritual literature, many of these great sages, men and also women, were retired householders. They were the teachers who taught Vedas to children who flocked to their Vedic hermitages in ancient times. These retired householders. In fact, that's called, they're called Vanaprasthina, means the third stage. So Bharata was a very wise person. So he decided he declared his eldest son as the next king and retired to the forest. He put up a small thatched hut and stayed there for many years, spending his time in contemplation, meditation, reading scriptures. And one day it so happened that, there was a river right in front of his hermitage. And one day he observed a female deer, which is pregnant, was being chased by a lion. The deer tried to jump across the small stream. In the process, it fell dead in the water. The king felt great compassion. So the king jumped into the stream, saved the baby deer. By the time the mother deer had died, a lion ran away. And this little baby deer grew up in the hermitage. Now remember what happened. The king who had left his own children and grandchildren, his palace and kingdom, became so attached to the baby deer that when he grew old, he died not thinking of God, but thinking of the deer. So it's a deviation, really. So in the Bhagavata Purana, it is stated, Etavan Sankhyogabhyam Sudharma Parinishtaya Janma Labha Parapumsam Ante Narayana Smriti. What it means is, whether through Karma Yoga and selfish action, or spiritual contemplation, or through devotion to God, you should be able to leave this world, die with God's form in your heart and God's name in your lips. That should be the last goal of every human being. He knew that, he has studied all this. But what happened, this king who had left all that he had, the kingdom, the palace, his ministers, his children, grandchildren, now became so attached, in a very obsessive way, attached the little baby deer. And oh, who will look after this deer after I die? This little animal. She was so much worried. So when he died, he was born as a deer. Now, you may ask the question, is it wrong to show compassion to animals? It is perfectly all right. But he should have showed all compassion, all mercy. But keeping in mind that this compassion, this mercy, he is showing because he is a spiritual seeker. It is a kind of worshipping the Lord. But he forgot the Lord, God, and he practically worshipped. And he was so mentally attached, the little baby deer, out of compassion, of course. But then he died. And when he died, he was born as a deer. But remember, he was a great king, a very wise person, who renounced a kingdom, his palace, his children, and had taken to spiritual life. So all those efforts will not go in vain. So when he was born as a deer, the deer remembered, it did not mix with other ordinary animals. It went to a hermitage and stayed. It did not come out of it. And after long years, it also died. When it died, it was born as a great sage. So the king died, was born as deer, and the deer died, was born as sage. Because the king himself was a sage. So his deer birth did not cause any degradation because he had brought with him this bag of samskaras, these memories, these impressions. So it did not go in vain. It's like being born with a heavy bank balance, spiritual bank balance. So when he was born, he remembered some of his experiences. And he knew that he should be very careful because he showed compassion in the previous life. The king showed compassion to the baby deer. It was certainly good, but he should be very careful. You should show compassion, everything. If you can look at the world through God's, through the spiritual perspective, then you will get both. If you look at God through world, then you will lose both. So we should be able to look at the world from a spiritual perspective. Then what happens? Every act, even ordinary work, becomes as sacred, as holy, as an act of worship. Because you see God everywhere. You are looking at the world through the spectacle. To this prism. What is that? God. But if you look at God through this world, then we bring God down to our, to this world level. Then we disinherit both. In the case of this king, he was born as a deer, then as a sage, and he led a very great life, and he became a great teacher, and one day he was traveling, he was moving, and one king mistook him to be a very ordinary person and asked him to carry his palanquin. And when he was not very careful in bearing the weight of the palanquin, the king, the Hugana, got down and scolded him. When the king scolded the sage, who was actually Bharata in the previous life, the sage gave some answers. Immediately the king understood that here is a great man. So he learned from him. He fell at his feet. That's how the story goes. But the next part of the story is not important in this particular context. So what it means is, we have to keep in mind not just the 10 feet of the iceberg that we see in front of us. So if you see only the present life, the present actions, and if you look at the whole thing from our mental perspective, is like mistaking a 100-foot iceberg to be a 10-foot piece of ice that is visible above the water level, forgetting the 90 feet that's below. So anyway, now we will have interaction, that we may continue the discussion next tomorrow. So we will have interaction perhaps for about 25 minutes.
Swamiji, you are talking about this karmashtraya. I have a habit which irritates my wife very badly. For her, I mean, I just cannot get rid of it. Okay? It is the way I have been born. I'm sorry, I'm not born. It is the way I have cultivated from my childhood, which it is very, very, very difficult for me to get rid of. It happens at an instant. So is this because of my karma is happening or?
Well, first of all, I don't know what it is.
Yes,
but
sir.
If it is, no. The second point is, of course, coming. You know, the second, of course, you need not discuss. I mean, the whole point is, if it is something like washing your hand again and again, mm-hmm. or watching whether the door is locked again and again, mm-hmm. I'm not going to those details. Many of these obsessions, sometimes they interpret in terms of if it cannot be explained in the light of your experiences in this life. But one general instruction that could be given is, if it is really causing a lot of difficulties, then you think of these difficulties and think of how wonderful it would be if you can get rid of this, which creates a lot of irritation in your life. That may help you to slowly get out of this. Or if it is spending time in, reading books, which you may think were purely intellectual, nothing to do with spiritual life, then you can slowly sublimate some of the underlying intentions behind this action to a higher level. So a subject like this cannot be really discussed in a class like this, you know, more personal. So it can be discussed only at a personal level. Without understanding that, all that we can do is give some general ideas, which doesn't always help, you know. So that.
Thank you so much.
Yeah.
I understand.
Namaste, Guruji. I wanted to ask you about something that you mentioned this morning about bridging the gap between intellect and the mind.
Yeah.
And cultivating a pure mind and the idea of a pure mind.
Yeah.
You talked about how we could be involved in certain activities that help you do that, read a good book, attend discussion, be in the company of people in the pursuit of spirituality. My question, if you please give me a little latitude, I will explain my predicament, is more practical than conceptual. As long as we are here and listening to you and reading a book, there is a temporary sense of willpower and strength in saying, okay, I'm better equipped to make right decisions and assert the true wishes of my intellect over my mind. But it is very temporary, and mind is like a drunk monkey, and there is very little control over that. Like you mentioned, while trying to meditate, it's like stirring up muck. So for an example, if I could give you an example, if I just walk down the street here to Civic Center and there is a fair going on there or a farmer's market and I have $20 and there's a homeless man, the best thing, the intellect would perhaps say, give the $20 to the homeless man and keep walking. And the mind would want to buy two pairs of beaded earrings at the farmer's market, right? So I can tell you that I will it's very seldom knowing what is the right thing and noble thing to do. Very 9 out of 10 times we're unable to do that. We come up with some compromise, maybe give that man a $10 sandwich and also buy a $10 pair of earrings. And the sad thing is, we're not even okay with that. There is the guilt afterwards, and then there is a self-loathing afterwards. So this whole exercise seems very difficult. So I would be grateful if you could provide us some kind of a practical tool to make, to bridge this gap and overcome that, overcome the mind's crazies, inclinations and proclivities.
Yeah, so one method of bridging the gap is to recollect and bring back to their mind the good ideas that you listen to. And this is possible by listening to these ideas again or by reading books which may give you similar ideas. Somehow keeping the mind constantly in touch with these ideas, once a day or once in a few days at least, will slowly help you to bridge the gap and bring your mind, compel your mind to do what your intellect really tells you to do. So at the beginning, there will be a conflict. In fact, conflict itself is a green signal, because you feel this conflict because you really want to do something noble. That's the beginning, in fact. But once you feel this, then you can very easily you can reinforce the will to do good thing by bringing back to your mind these ideas, by listening again and by getting acquainted, by reviewing this acquaintance with these ideas, by reading, by thinking. All these are various means of narrowing the gap. So slowly you find the mental reluctance to do what really want to do will decrease. It may not disappear one day, but even the awareness that there is a conflict shows that you really want to do that. There's a strong will, and part of the mind is willing to cooperate. But you are not able to do that because the other party is not willing to cooperate. So you can increase the positive aspect of the mental system by reinforcing it, by renewing its acquaintance, familiarity with these ideas, by reading again, listening to, and thinking of it. That's how we do that. All spiritual sadhanas are different ways of narrowing this gap. That's the thing. All practices. When you meditate, when you pray, when you read scriptures, when you discuss this, what you are really doing is you are trying to bring what you want to do to what you are actually able to do. You are trying to bring the mind to the level of the mind. Sorry, bringing the level of the intellect to the level of mind. I mean, you are trying to narrow the gap between what you want to do and what you eventually end up doing. The block is slowly decreased. The bridge is narrowed through constantly reinforcing the positive dimension of the mental system. This can be done through prayer. This can be done through getting acquainted with these ideas again and again. That's the idea.
Namaste, Swamiji. This may be related to the higher dimension of looking at the problems that you mentioned earlier in the morning. What is sainthood? Can it only be attained through religious and spiritual service? Or can it also be attained by selfless service to his or her fellow beings by any other means?
Yeah. Yes. You know, sainthood is nothing but a level of spiritual evolution. which is possible through religion as it is understood in conventional terms, but it is not confined to that. You can even be spiritual. You can be a saint without being religious in the conventional sense of the word religion. So, normally, you know, when we talk about religion, we talk about four limiting factors. One, a book that you consider to be holy, which contains the wisdom of God, and in some cases, which contains the whole of God's wisdom. It is really blasphemy, of course. The second, the idea of a place where you associate the presence of God or where you focus on doing things related to religious practices, place of worship. The third is a particular individual whom you consider to be the one central figure in that religious tradition. The fourth one, a set of rituals and ceremonies, which are important. Of course, a fifth one is the intermediary, priest or anybody for the matter. So this is what we normally mean by religion, though, according to Vivekananda, religion goes far beyond all this. He calls them prison walls of religion or the kindergarten of religion, two approaches you find Vivekananda's works. So true spirituality goes beyond this, but it's not opposed to this. True spirituality goes beyond all this. See, Buddha is an example who doesn't belong to this particular category of religious persons. So true sainthood can be defined as practicing spirituality in everyday life. That is true sainthood. In a way, coming down to very, very common sense level, a person who may be living this world, but he has a link to something beyond this world. That is the real meaning of a saint. After every human being has the burden of being born a particular individual in a culture, in language, or in a country, or whatever it is, irrespective of all these diversities, a saint will have a link to something that is transcendental, something which is not earthly. That's what really makes him a saint. So that's what it means. This is the most general definition that we can give. Going deeper, there are many, many different approaches.
Hi, Swamiji. So this may be a metaphysical question. So how do I know the memories of the past life, like the deer in the story, so that I become aware of my own true self in this life?
Yes, of course. In the scriptures, you say there are different things, you know. One is if you have a tendency which may be positive or negative, let us say positive tendency, and when you follow that tendency, when you work out that particular tendency, you feel a kind of natural inner poise, spontaneous ecstasy. And if you feel that there is no logical explanation for that tendency in the light of your upbringing, your education, or what you went through in this life, then that tendency must have a cause somewhere else. Because no human tendency can evolve from a vacuum. That modern psychology also explains. So there's no vacuum assets. So if you have a tendency, a very strong habit, a natural spontaneous habit or tendency, which cannot be explained, logically explained in the light of experiences in this life, education, upbringing, then it must have its source somewhere else. extending the logic beyond the spectrum of this life. Where does it come from? So what then point is, when you manifest the tendency, when you work out the tendency, you feel a kind of inner naturalness without any conflict. What do you call you when you go to a place, you feel, I've been here earlier, I've seen this person earlier. Deja vu, what you call it. So I'm not that figure of speech or anything. But that's one way of explaining this. You feel that it is an inner experience. You don't read Edgar Cayce. He extended everything to an extreme level, you know, so people started laughing at him. But there's a lot of logical, rational explanation, point in what he said. I mean, because, of course, now nobody reads this. But the whole point is, when we have a tendency, a habit, which we feel very much at home with, which we feel a lot of spontaneity, naturalness, and you don't have any conflict, you feel it belongs to you. You are being in acquaintance with it sometime in the past. Then it has its source elsewhere, not in this life. That's only way. I can put only in very abstract language without really focusing on the particular cases.
Pranam Maharaj, I have a couple of questions on Vanaprastha.
Yeah.
So you gave three examples of why when one is ready to go to Vanaprastha, hair getting gray, wrinkle, and grandchildren.
Yeah.
So I don't know what I am in that respect. I don't have grandchildren, but the rest is up to debate. But is there any kind of... sign that, okay, you are now ready for Vanaprastha mentally? So that is one question. And once you are in that stage, in this world now, people used to go to forest. So here, what are the things that we should be doing in that stage?
Yeah.
So these are the two questions.
Yes. You know, the concept itself originated in ancient times. So the word has a meaning which may not be very rational in today's terms. So what it means is, see, when we have fulfilled our duties and responsibilities to the new generation, we have done our duty, society, nation, then we have to think of some higher values. In fact, you are not separating yourself from your previous stages of life. So Vanaprastha should be explained in Sanskrit word. What it means is, I shall explain at the very beginning, what it means is this. The first stage in all human life evolution is Brahmacharya, which means study. When you are a student preparing, acquiring the knowledge that will help you to play the role of a sensible, responsible householder. Maybe wife or husband or mother or son or daughter or sister, whatever it may be. How we must become responsible householders, members of a family, responsible member of society, citizen of the nation, and so on. That is the second stage. First stage is preparation, Brahmacharya Ashrama. Second stage is householdership. The third stage is, as I mentioned, when an householder has already done his duty or her duty to family, children, society, and nation. Then there is something higher than what you have already acquired in the life of an householder. Money, wealth, everything. No, you are not in need of them. I mean, you don't have to continue your effort to accumulate them more and more. So what to do? Is there something beyond these empirical things, which are the concerns of an householder? So you have to pay taxes, you have good health care, everything is there. But is there nothing beyond all this? What's the meaning of life? So you have to prepare for a higher life by withdrawing from active responsibilities, from day-to-day activities for acquiring wealth and other necessities which are necessary for leading the life of a householder. Now you don't have to continue those efforts anymore. Not that you become inactive or you become lazy. No. You go beyond it. You transcend it. It is not that we arbitrary, no, tomorrow onwards, I won't know that way. Mentally we feel an internal mental maturity for a higher life. So what does it mean? So husband and wife together, they start leading a contemplative life. It doesn't mean that they won't do anything other than just contemplation 24 hours. No. But you give a higher priority to the contemplative, the spiritual aspect of your life. Spirituality, contemplation are important in the life of an householder also. But now you give a higher priority to this. That's because for two reasons. First of all, it is necessary for the harmony in family life and social life. Because one must be able to make proper use of leisure. See, the ability to say enough and the ability to say no is very important in solving the problems of life and in getting contentment. And this we don't do by arbitrarily, no, tomorrow onwards, no, by going beyond. There's a gradual friction-free evolution. No friction, no jerking, not a bumpy road. Gradual evolution. So we can spend more time reading scriptures, helping people, maybe helping deserving people in society. So that is what is meant by vanaprastha. Maybe that's what it should mean in modern times. Because that, in fact, there is a reason, a real reason why I decided to choose this subject. Three times I had the occasion to meet a very aged Swami who was here in a daycare home in San Rafael, Swami Vedanandaji. That Swami was a very contemplative person. He'll be sitting there in a chair. It's a daycare home. But then, three times I went, all the three occasions I heard terrible noises all around. A big TV screen was there. Lot of shooting, you know, Terminator 1, 2, 3, all this. Now, it is really a terrifying revelation to me. So, of course, this is happening in many old age homes in India also, unfortunately. But there is a real effort to introduce these things along with that, at least. Some effort is going on. So that prompted me to introduce this idea. So maybe in this 21st century, in 2016, the idea of going to a forest may not be a very viable or practical thing to do. But the idea of saying enough, when you have retired, you accumulated enough, the family is doing fine, and maybe spending more time, more energy, more effort for spiritual pursuits. I mean, thinking, now it's fine, what next? If you don't ask this question, the alternative is frustration, a terrible feeling of vacuum, inner vacuum within. Because I'm not blaming, but the problem of Abrahamic religion is you have got only one life. And if you are not ready, at the end of this life, you are gone. So Vedanta and Yoga and Buddhism and all this give you. No, it's not just one life. So even when you're old, you can start acquiring new wealth, a different kind of wealth. Not bank balance, something else that will help you to update, to get a promotion in your evolution. Accumulating spiritual ideas, contemplating spiritual ideas. That's why in ancient times, the greatest and most sacred and most solid way of accumulating spiritual wealth for a contemplative person, for a vanaprasthin was to teach scriptures to children, brahmacharis. That's why you find throughout Vedic literature, the mythological literature, you come across thousands of sages living in hermitages with their wife, aged husband and wife, teaching children. So kings and rich men, philanthropists, used to donate money, wealth, everything to these hermitages so that they will be able to support these children. It's an ancient Vedic system. Now it is certainly not relevant as such, but then the ideal can be a very important way of solving many of the problems that our society is facing today. The feeling of total emptiness, the question, what next? See, we have everything. Everything fine. The daycare home looks after everything. What next? So the absence of a physical problem becomes a serious problem. If you don't have money, you work hard, take loans from a bank, and then you work in Trader Joe's, $15 per day. Every day you work 4 hours, you pay back, you get a degree, you get a job. That is fine. That's not a problem. The problem is we have got everything, but still nothing to look for, nothing to strive for. The problem that arises out of having no problem, no challenge. See, if you don't have any challenge to face at the physical level, it becomes a big challenge at the mental level. That's why we want to run away from an unpleasant, a tormenting mind. That's why we watch the Terminator 1 and 2. You know, actually, it is a running away from self-torture. Because you are not willing to sit alone. Solitude becomes a great torment. A feeling of torture, internal torture. If you can sit quiet and contemplate and enjoy, that's a real sign of wisdom in old age. Somebody says, I cannot keep 1 minute, I should be always active. Actually, it's not a virtue for an aged person. An aged person should learn to remain quiet and enjoy peace of solitude. Solitude should not become a source of trouble. So that is the psychology behind this concept of third stage, Vanaprasthashrama. It was very scientifically, rationally analyzed method of evolving beyond the stage of active responsibilities and obligations, where you have some responsibility, but a higher responsibility, how to preserve the spiritual culture by teaching to other people. So that's the idea behind it. So we will continue the discussion, the last session tomorrow at 10 o'clock. Thank you. Namaskar. Om Shanti 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 Hari Om Tat Sat Sri Ramakrishna Pranamastu.